Okay, so we are traveling through Mark chapter 6 now. And we're going to be hitting this narrative of the feeding of the 5,000. Now, this is one story that is found in all of the four Gospels. And so we've heard it many, many times. It's a common children's story. Hear it in sermons all the time. And so, you know, wonder, so how much, what else can be learned from it? You know, is there anything more to be learned?
It's pretty simple.
No.
As we've heard it.
In our minds, we have a picture of how this story is supposed to unfold. Which is actually, in some ways, is probably an amalgamation of all four of the accounts.
Probably.
And so what that means is that what we have in our minds is not what's in any of the Gospels.
Okay.
Not only that, but it's also divorced from context. So we're going to look at the one in Mark, but we're also going to refer to how it's different from some of the others, the other accounts. Now, what we've seen so far in this chapter is that Jesus had gone to his hometown, Nazareth, and he had been rejected there by the people who knew him, even by his family. Immediately after that, he had called his disciples and sent them out as apostles to proclaim the gospel, to preach, and to cast out demons, to heal. We also saw that in the literary form that Mark has provided, this apostle narrative of sending out and coming back is interrupted by a flashback to the account of Herod Antipas and John the Baptist and the execution of John. The Herod story was a story about a king. It's about a story about a kingdom and a banquet of death. The story of the feeding of the multitude occurs immediately following this Herod story. So it is, among other things, the story of a different king, a different kingdom, and a different kind of a banquet.
Drastic change in tune from the Herod story.
So Mark records another feeding of the multitude, the 4,000, that comes a little later. And so in this discussion, we'll also note how some of these two feeding miracles complement one another and provide a fuller picture into the kingdom of God and Mark's intent for his audience. A commentary reads here, the account of the feeding of the multitude on the shores of Lake Gennesaret, which is the Sea of Galilee, possesses a particular significance in the framework of Mark's Gospel. Its elaborate introduction, verses 30 through 34, the extended dialogue with the disciples, verses 35 through 38, as well as subsequent references to this occasion in verse 52 and then in chapter 8, verses 17 to 21, and its sequel in the feeding of the 4,000 that's found in chapter 8, verses 1 to 10, show that the evangelist regarded this event as crucial for understanding the dignity of Jesus. Its position in the Markan framework after the account of Herod's feast juxtaposes the sumptuous oriental aura of the Herodian court with the austere circumstances in which Jesus satisfied the multitude with the staples of a peasant's diet.
The contrast is intentional.
In spite of the Tetrarch's pretensions to royalty, the people are as leaderless as sheep who possess no shepherd. In contrast to the drunken debauchery of the Herodian feast, Mark exhibits the glory of God unveiled through the abundant provision of bread in the wilderness, where Jesus is Israel's faithful shepherd. So we get to this introduction to the feeding of the 5,000. verses 30 through 34. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. The first verse 30 is the closing of the previous sandwich narrative. It's the return of the disciples, and it therefore serves also as an introduction into this a transition. Verse 31 shows that crowds were continuing to come to the disciples even though their short-term mission trip was over, and they were so overwhelmed that they had no time to eat. This echoes chapter 3, verse 20, where Jesus is reported as being so busy so as not to have time to eat, and where his family thought he had gone mad.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, in response, Jesus says, "Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while." Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things here to be noted is self-care is equally important as acts of service. You can be so busy doing things for someone else that you forget to take care of yourself. And that could, you know, that, if that continues,
it's destructive.
Yeah, you will be of no help to anyone. Mm-hmm. Now, the gospel cannot be proclaimed and lived if the apostle is tired and cranky.
Tired and cranky.
And this begins a new unit within this gospel. It begins with a boat journey, and it's going to close with one that in later in chapter 8. Desolate place is going to be mentioned a number of times, twice already in this introduction. A desolate place does not mean barren, although we have kind of that implication. Mm-hmm. So in Mark's case, this is, we're going to see that this desolate place is metaphorically desolate. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean barren, but away from cities and towns, away from population centers and travel routes. Away from people.
Mm-hmm. Away from where there are supposed to be people.
So throughout Mark's gospel, the wilderness is where critical spiritual moments occur. Jesus' temptation occurred in the wilderness, is kind of going out to pray, to focus on his mission, happens there. It's where Jesus slowly reveals the nature of his kingdom. The teaching by the sea and the parables are also taught by the sea. You know, they're not taught in the synagogue where people are expected to be, but rather, you know, it's away from these places. Commentary reads that God provides rest for his people within the wilderness is a recurring theme in the scripture. It was a literal rest of the wilderness generation led by Moses and Joshua, which became the type of the final rest promised to the people of God in a second Exodus in the preaching of Isaiah and Jeremiah. The ancient hope of rest within the wilderness is to be fulfilled as Jesus gathers his disciples to a wilderness place that they may be by themselves. The disciples and the multitudes who pursue them prove to be the people of the new Exodus. The presence of Jesus and the provision of God will give to this time of withdrawal the character of rest within the wilderness. Mark paints in his account a vivid picture of Jesus and his disciples sailing away, and the crowd, noticing this, literally run. This run is only in Mark. To keep up along the shore to get to the destination before Jesus. Mm-hmm. What might be the significance of this detail? You know, in all the other accounts, or in Matthew and Luke, the crowd simply follows. Mark says run. John doesn't describe the crowds. They're this mm-hmm. boat journey. They're just there. Mm-hmm. All of them. Mm-hmm. And this idea that there's the people are like sheep without a shepherd.
When they realize where where Jesus and the apostles are going, they dash around to get there before him so that they can be close to this person who they don't even understand.
Sheep without a shepherd. Sheep with faithless shepherds distracted by idols that do not save, that do not provide for the life and well-being of the sheep. Sheep with exploitative shepherds who use the sheep for their own gain. Having sustained suffering and deep wounds at the hands of such shepherds, some of these sheep remain in the pews of present-day congregations, but daring never to trust the shepherd again. Jesus was confronted by a shepherdless crowd, a crowd lacking a true shepherd, a crowd whose leaders, Herod and the Pharisees, were not focused on the people's welfare, but instead on their own agendas. The people chased after Jesus. Was it because of his many acts of healing and casting out demons, or was it something else? Was it simply because Jesus could provide their physical needs, could fix their physical problems that they followed him, or was it something else?
I think at least some of the people realized there was something more. Even if they didn't know what it was, they could see that there's something to this person and they needed to follow him. And so they ran after him.
Only Mark describes this crowd as sheep without a shepherd. So what might Mark be communicating by this analogy?
John's disciples.
Well, that might be part of it, since we just read about John being killed, and he did have disciples. That makes sense. What else?
It's an allusion back to a number of Old Testament passages. In the first of these two feeding miracles in the Gospel, Jesus is pictured as the faithful shepherd promised to Israel in the prophetic and apocalyptic literature, such as Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and the Psalms of Solomon. Both Moses and David had been shepherds, and the shepherd had become a metaphor for the religious and political leaders of Israel. This connection.
And so the people are supposed to have a shepherd.
People are supposed to have a shepherd, but what Mark is saying is that these people are like sheep without a shepherd. So
the idea of the people needing a shepherd isn't a new thing, and the people like Herod are supposed to be the shepherds, and that's already a metaphor in use during the day, maybe. That's interesting.
This connection of Jesus' feeding miracle with Moses is further substantiated by the reference to the people as like sheep without a shepherd, which seems to be an allusion to Numbers chapter 27, verse 17, where Moses prays for God to supply a leader after him to take his role. This description of the people also brings to mind Ezekiel chapter 34, verses 1 through 31, where God promises to feed his sheep by sending a king like David to be their shepherd.
Are the people running after him because they don't want to look like people without a shepherd?
I don't know. Or maybe because they realize that here is the shepherd that we have been...
Okay, I was just seeing if it was something that, like...
An image?
The people already in Mark, Jesus' teaching is described as having authority.
Okay, so this isn't something where people are standing around trying to make sure that nobody knows that they don't know, so they're going after what, trying to keep along with the crowd is what I was asking. Not necessarily, Okay.
Well, the people recognize in Jesus an authority that they're civil and religious leaders up to this point have not demonstrated.
They've had they've had people who are supposed to be the shepherds and not acting like it. Okay.
I think there's an interesting implication here. Herod had a title, Tetrarch. The religious leaders had titles, priests or scribes, members of the Sanhedrin. But appointment does not confer authority.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
At least not the kind of authority that people are willing to submit to.
Right.
Well, you can impose authority and people will submit.
Yes.
Because they fear the consequences.
But imposed authority is very different than natural authority. Mm-hmm. That people willingly follow.
So Jesus doesn't send the crowd away. Remember, they had gone over to a desolate place in order to come away from the crowds and rest.
So it might be natural to say, no, we're taking a break, everybody go away.
So Jesus doesn't send the crowd away, but rather begins to teach them. Jesus healed here also. And so actual rest is going to have to wait a little while.
Yeah.
So far in this gospel account of Mark, Jesus really has demonstrated the what of the gospel. He has, we've seen the proclamation, we've seen the casting out of demons and the healings. But now we get to the why. He had compassion on them. I think what it says is that the what of the gospel, or the how of the gospel, is of no lasting value without the why. And there's a note on this word compassion. Compassion is a weak rendering of what was going on within Jesus. The Greek word refers to a churning of the gut. Jesus was churning on his insides because those in the crowd were like sheep without a shepherd. What motivates God? And what does this motivation tell us about the kingdom of God?
What motivates God? Doing the best for the people who need it. Working in the best interest of the powerless.
Well, that's the what.
Yeah.
What happens.
But why?
Yeah, what is the motivation?
Suffering.
Okay. This idea of sheep without a shepherd. He had compassion.
Well, love. A leader or master who actually loves the regular people as opposed to Herod or the priests. That you didn't have that. You didn't have a leader who actually cared about the people. And here the people sense that they found a leader who loves each one. And that's unheard of, revolutionary.
Sometimes in present day church settings, we hear, you know, God wants to use you. Or we were made to serve God. Does that describe the kingdom of God? Where human beings are tools.
And we're made to serve God. No, I don't think it does. I mean, we're made to be loved by God. And when we are loved by God, then we can love the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And show God's love to the rest of the world. And I think that's a lot different than starting at the point of us being made to serve God. That's weird, yeah. Never really thought of it that way before, but made to serve God assumes self-interest on God's part, and that we are simply the tools, rather than that we are subjects of God's love, first and foremost, and because of that we can pass that along. Wow. Huh. Yeah. I never thought about that phrase, made to serve God.
I mean, I think, you know, God,
really
God wants us to serve Him, but we weren't made to serve God. I think there's a difference there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of intent.
Or you could even say, God wants us to serve the world. By imparting His best interest to the world around us, are we really serving God? Or are we living out His intention, being fully who He wants us to be, and living out His intention by serving the people around us? Mm-hmm. That kind of makes more sense. Rather than serving God. God requires servants.
We were made to be recipients of His love.
Yeah.
And we were made to be masters of this earth.
Yeah. Or even conduits of His love to the people around us.
Yeah.
Recipients and conduits, mm-hmm. rather than servants.
Yeah, that kind of takes the freedom away.
Yeah. As in, you have no real value in yourself other than how you can provide value to God.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, not so much. You think? Were you made to serve God? Or were you made to be loved by God?
So before we leave this introduction part, what might this passage teach us about balancing ministry and rest?
You busy little body. You're so busy.
Well, Jesus and the disciples went off because they needed rest, yet when they reached their destination, they kind of were forced into doing more ministry.
They went off to take a break. And when they get there, the people that they are serving have appeared there too.
Thank you. So, any thoughts on how do we balance the needs of ministry and our need for rest?
I know. I have no idea.
So, Mark's asking, or kind of trying to lighten or look at a subject so that people see that it's kind of like you have to be nourished yourself before you can nourish others. And so your relationships with God needs to be fulfilled long before you can spend the time and energy to give that to somebody else. Otherwise, you're taking two people down instead of one.
Yeah, and that would be the ideal, but sometimes, like this story is showing, the demands of ministry come up that you cannot ignore.
So,
and you're already tired.
So is the fruit that has been gained from this tiny little speck that it was created enough to give so many people food, is it saying in an analogy that God's, our relationships with God and His love is, even in its least amount, can be great enough in us to give that much to other people even when we're that tired?
Maybe sometimes you just can't give anymore. And maybe in this parable, it's saying they're at the point where they can't give anymore. And sometimes at that point, God provides the more for you to give. Sometimes you're at a place where you can't give anymore, and sometimes you just have to step away. But maybe sometimes at that point, God can provide the more for you to give until you can step away.
Yeah, maybe it's important to note that Jesus wasn't leading his disciples to a place where they expected to minister. You know, they weren't going to do more ministry, but rather they were going to go rest. That was their intent, but they encountered unforeseen circumstances. Maybe that's the difference. There are sometimes in ministry we feel this need to do more. And maybe that's different from coming across occasions where you are prompted to give even when you are tired.
They call that the Han Solo effect.
So now we get to the actual part where the people are gathered and it is getting late. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. This desolate place is repeated for emphasis. The wilderness setting of the feeding miracle reminds the audience of the Isaiah theme of the new Exodus and God's miraculous provision of manna during the original Exodus. And also, Mark may have meant to draw some parallel between this feeding and the supply of manna to the Israelites in the wilderness under the leadership of Moses. In the synoptics, so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it is the disciples who initiate the conversation about food. They observe, air quotes, observe, "It is late. Send them away." In John's gospel account, it is Jesus who initiates, and John writes that Jesus already knew what he was going to do. in the synoptics, in response to the disciples requesting Jesus to go send away the crowd so they can buy themselves something to eat, Jesus responds by commanding the disciples to give the crowd something to eat. Mark and John, their accounts include the detail that the disciples questioned Jesus' request by observing that it would require at least 200 denarii to feed the crowd. 200 denarii is two-thirds to 1 year of an average laborer's wages. So that's a considerable amount.
Wow, yeah.
Now we're talking maybe, in today's dollars, $30,000, $35,000.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Which is a considerable sum, and something that obviously they would not be carrying around.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that, no, even if they had that much, they wouldn't, it wouldn't be enough to fully feed the crowd. Now, only in Mark then has Jesus specifically asking the disciples what food they have among them. Matthew and Luke has the disciples immediately notifying Jesus of what they already have.
Mm-hmm.
John has Andrew discovering a boy who has food.
Mm. Yeah.
So what might be the significance of Mark, where he, in his retelling, he has Jesus asking the disciples to go check, what do you have?
Well, so far, if you're asking your disciples to come to a place where I have rest for you, and it's Jesus, and it's like, oh, whoops, there's a bunch of people here. How did he miss that one coming? And then, two, it's like, well, he's basically, it sounds more like he's, Mark is asking you to think like these people that are kind of somewhat being tested in a way to think with the faith that Jesus is going to provide for them rather than pragmatically thinking, oh, okay, it's time to go rest now. And
mm-hmm.
and they say, oh, well, it's the hour's getting late now, Jesus. We need to send him away. And he's like, oh, okay, but
Jesus,
they need some food
prompting first.
He keeps asking them to be prompting, exactly, prompting.
He keeps prompting them to help the people. As in, it's not all about me. I want you to help the people. What can you do for the people?
Well, but he's also, instead of asking them to help them, though, it's more like he's waiting for the disciples to say to him, mm-hmm. oh, well, we know you got this.
and he also wants them to discover that they can't.
Well, but that they can believe in him to take care of it for them, or to help
right.
them. Anyway, that's kind of what I'm getting
at. He wants them to come to a point where they can realize, oh, but you can provide for us, and then we can help the people.
Right.
Okay. Here's a bit from a commentary. The extended conversation of Jesus with his disciples concerning bread is the distinctive element in the Markan account of the feeding of the multitude. Jesus, in contrast to the circumstances depicted in all of the other miracles, appears deliberately to create the situation in which the people must be fed. His instructions to the disciples to feed the people and to count their reserves of bread signify unambiguously that the food had to be provided through the disciples, not from the multitude. Some scholars place significance on the five, noting that it is a reference to the Torah, the five books of the law for the Jews. This is in contrast to the seven loaves of the feeding of the 4,000, where seven represents completeness, in other words, of the entire world. So, the feeding of the 5,000 takes place in Jewish territory, where the five books of Moses would be an important factor. Whereas in Gentile territory, the Torah would make no sense.
Right.
but rather the idea that seven representing completeness, the inclusion of Gentiles, the entire world.
So that's why there would be the different rewrites of the same parable, so that it is actually written into the cultural subtext of the people that would be reading.
Each gospel writer has a particular message that he is trying to communicate and convey.
And these are almost geographically reasoned for their rewrite then?
So these are theological writings. They're not historical.
Right.
So they are based on history, but they are first and foremost theological. In other words, the authors felt free to change details, add things, take things away.
So that they would be more apt to be read and actually agreed with or taken in by the readers that they're trying to write these to.
Yeah. So here's what commentary says in regards to that. Specific numbers provided a memory assist for those who passed along the story in its oral form. These numbers also connected the story to the scriptures of Mark's church. For example, the five books of Moses, the 12 tribes of Israel. Now recall the numbers Mark uses in his second feeding story, seven loaves and baskets, a number signifying the whole of creation that God called into being in 7 days, and 4,000 people indicating the four cardinal points of a compass. It looks as if Mark has expanded the scope of his narrative from the particular a Jewish crowd to the general. Jesus feeds both Jews and Gentiles. So, when we see numbers in the Bible, they often have a symbolic significance. No, they aren't necessarily meant to be taken as literal fact.
Well, they're almost always... Not always, but they're actually trying to refer the reader to something that has to do with culturally in their.
Quite often, so
it's just you were saying. It's
when
culturally.
We see numbers, we need to ask: is this supposed to be understood as fact, or is it symbolic of something else?
Right.
So we've talked about some of the differences in the different accounts. What was going on in the minds of the disciples? What do you think?
I think they were like apprentices that were kind of a little bit tired in a way.
Well, I'm sure they're quite tired.
And they're just kind of like they're at the final stage a little bit where they're just like, and I want to be done.
Yeah, they're suffering from compassion fatigue.
Right. Yeah.
They've been giving, and they have nothing left to give.
But what they don't realize is that Christ isn't asking them to give themselves. He's asking them to give him.
Of him.
Well, he's asking them to give him their faith now, not their compassion to those people, their will to make them feel better, their will to say that God is here for you, but to say to the disciples, now this is actually their lesson. This has nothing to do with the multitude of people. This isn't about actually the people themselves. It's more about the disciples understanding the lesson that Jesus is now trying to teach them. That's what I think
is
going through their heads, though, pardon me, because they're like dumb teenagers that are just like, wow, we're tired.
And they are learning how to just be a conduit for Jesus.
Right.
Rather than needing to have it all before you can give.
Right.
Just being a conduit so that Jesus can work in the world.
So you can portray the faith that people need to have.
Uh-huh.
That's what I think.
One commentary notes that disciples, when they were sent out, they were to take no bread, no bag, no money in their belts on their mission trip. Yet in the hours after their return, they come up with food among their midst. Perhaps this is why Mark is Jesus asking directly, how many loaves do you have? What might this say about what Mark wants to communicate?
So they were bringing stuff with them then? When they weren't supposed to?
Maybe.
Because that's kind of what you're saying then. Is
that's
like,
what one commentary writer, you know, kind of observes is that, you know, they weren't supposed to have any food among them.
So was that another, like, that was another point of Christ saying, like, well, what? Why didn't you believe me?
Yeah.
What do you have?
It could be.
Yeah, like, I know you've got some Twinkies back there. I told you not to have any. Okay.
So, maybe what Mark is...
Maybe it's that they didn't bring anything with them, but then when they came back, they ended up having food.
Maybe they did.
But they weren't supposed to... They were supposed to rely completely on the hospitality of others, and they weren't supposed to...
Right.
To save for themselves just in case.
Right.
You know, just in case they came to a village that wasn't hospitable. They weren't supposed to carry food around.
So if they got back and they've been collecting from each village and carrying to the next one just to make sure they don't need anything on the way or something. Well, maybe.
Did they go out and look for food and then come back to Christ, or did he just ask them outright, what do you got?
In Mark's account, Jesus asks the disciples, what do you have?
Right, right. And that's where he's portraying that he's deliberately showing the disciples, as they're speaking to him, their neglect in faith in him to provide for them what they have. So when he says, what do you got? And they're like, well, yeah, we've been carrying these around for a little while and this is what we have. That's a direct neglect of Christ's faith that they're supposed to be giving to those people. That's where they're supposed to be getting their strength to give faith, is that they have enough faith to take that.
And what were you saying?
I'm wondering if maybe the first part of the lesson leading into it was that even though they didn't take anything with them, maybe because of generosity or because of whatever.
That may be.
Even having not put anything in their bags, not carrying anything with them, when they arrived there, they ended up having food.
That may be, but I think in the way Mark's literary form is, it's with Jesus asking that a very direct, pointed question, only in Mark, I think it points to the fact that the disciples had less faith than they were supposed to.
Maybe.
Now, that other interpretations may be read from other Gospels. Stick to what Mark has.
Well, because that's the point that Mark is trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he is saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Interesting. Okay.
So what we're seeing is that these differences in the Gospels, they have different points, and some of them may actually become contradictory. That's okay.
Yeah.
But they might be, what you're saying is ideally... You used the term, and I can't remember it now, but to their cultural way of thinking with Mark or John, John's talking to a totally different group of people. So the boy coming up with the food, was that in John's or was that... Okay, so the boy coming up with the food is more of a gift of the Gentiles to be taken care of, whereas... With the Jewish population, they need to realize that they can't always hold a trump card to make sure that they can get out of whatever it is that they're supposed to be logistically getting out of.
And in fact, it may have been a little boy who had the bread and fish.
Right.
In John's Gospel, Andrew is, when he appears, is portrayed as one who is bringing people to Jesus.
Right. Right. But in this version, it sounds more like he's trying to And this could just be now in our day and age, we don't necessarily always have the distinct cultural patterns, but some individuals might be that type of person where it's like, well, I'm going to hold on to a little bit of my own strength, make sure that I can do this too, and then I'm going to call on you when I need to type thing,
right,
if I need to, but I'm going to make sure I nibble on this for a long time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So now that Jesus has, and the disciples know what they have amongst them, Jesus continues. Then he commanded them all to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. And those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. Now notice that the desolate place now has green grass.
Yeah.
Now, the fact is, it probably always was grassy.
Yeah.
But what does it signify from a literary standpoint that a desolate place has been turned into a grassy field?
Oh, Psalm 23.
Yeah, what does Psalm 23 say?
Makes me lie down in green grass.
Yeah, green pastures.
Pastures. I was going to say grasses, but it didn't quite sound right.
So here's Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He lets me rest in grassy meadows. He leads me to restful waters. He keeps me alive. He guides me in proper paths for the sake of his good name. Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no danger because you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they protect me. You set a table for me right in front of my enemies. You bathe my head in oil. My cup is so full, it spills over. Yes, goodness and faithful love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live in the Lord's house as long as I live.
That's funny that it specifies sit down in groups on the green grass.
Mm-hmm. It's a deliberate allusion.
He makes me lie down in green pastures.
And he sets a table.
A table.
This shepherd is also a provider of a banquet.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
He
never saw that.
He protects. And there is so much that the cup spills over.
Uh-huh. It's a deliberate echo of Psalm 23. Interesting. So would the readers of Mark have seen Psalm 23 in that?
I'm certain. Mark could. There's no doubt Mark intended his audience, his readers, to refer
green
back
grass,
to Psalm 23.
Food, cup runs over. Huh. Cool.
This division into groups and companies echo that which Moses commanded. The camp was set up.
So in the middle, in the midst of this, writing back, alluding to all the suffering that's going on in
suffering,
time,
desolation.
He's referring. He's alluding from Psalm 23, saying,
"Yeah."
Saying God's gonna lead you through this, and you're gonna prosper.
Yeah. Even the little note that the people were organized into groups of hundreds and fifties may allude to Moses' organizing Israelites similarly during the wilderness march.
Uh-huh.
The effect of these characteristics not found in the parallels or in the feeding of the 4,000 is to show that the event here is not to be seen simply as a great miracle, but also as full of particular prophetic significance.
Interesting. Huh.
So as...
Cool.
Definitely through Mark's interpretation in his writing, but maybe as the people, you know, kind of saw them being grouped into 50s and 100s, maybe some of them would recognize this whole allusion back to Moses in the first Exodus, the first Israel. Mm-hmm. Then Jesus said a blessing. In other words, gave thanks. Jews give thanks. They do not ask for a blessing on the food. Asking a blessing is a pagan custom.
So the idea that in the mission field when the food is more uncertain, you be sure and bless it so that it'll be safe to eat. It's a pagan custom.
That's a pagan custom. What Jesus,
in Adventism, you hear that.
What Jesus did was he blessed God. He blessed God for providing food.
Uh-huh.
He didn't bless the food.
In Adventism...
That's the point that Mark's been making the whole time. He's trying to get them to realize that you're giving thanks to God for providing for you. And the important time to do it is when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you don't know if you're going to get any more.
Uh-huh. And you're not creating the blessing yourself.
Right.
You hear about that a lot in stories from the mission field. Be sure and bless the food. People, missionaries talk about making sure you bless the food so that it'll be safe for you to eat because you don't know if it will be otherwise.
Yeah, and so how Mark describes it is, in taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. These words describe Jesus' actions, which will be seen at the Last Supper and the Eucharist. The place where Mark's lesson about God's economy of plenty has been rooted most firmly in the Christian tradition is the Eucharist. It is no accident that the words and movement of this story vividly mirror the actions of the Eucharist. Provisions are offered, thanks is given, and the bread is shared. Just as in the Eucharist, what seems like so little turns out to supply abundantly the need. Now, a side note here.
Granted, there's no wine.
The more liberal theologians don't believe an actual miracle here occurred, but rather that the people shared the food that they already had with them after seeing the initial sharing by Jesus and the disciples.
I have seen that interpretation.
But Mark's interpretation does not allow for that. Uh-huh. He clearly wants people, his audience, to understand that this was a supernatural occurrence.
Interesting, though, that the people aren't aware of it.
There's no indication in this account that the people were aware of the miracle. Now, when you go to John's account, the people are quite aware of what was going on, and that's what led to them wanting to proclaim Jesus as king in that gospel.
I see.
The note on that one, the miracle took place before the multitude, but there is no indication in the Markan text that they had any realization of what was taking place. The simplicity of the meal Jesus provided is congruous with his general reluctance to perform miracles and give signs. There was nothing extraordinary in the peasant's fare which could call attention to itself. The messianic meal remained hidden from the thousands. The event is intended to be revelatory to the disciples alone.
Well, and sometimes the primary blessing from God is the ability to give to the people around you. Not as much. Well, yes, having enough to eat is certainly a blessing. But sometimes the most blessing is the ability to give to the people around you. And that's the miracle that is being focused on here.
Yeah, in Mark's literary form, it's all about the disciples. It's all about what the disciples were lacking and what they needed to learn. And so it's no surprise that Mark doesn't show the people being aware of it.
She's just bored.
And at the end, there was plenty to be had. No one went away less than satisfied. The text is emphatic that the loaves and fish were miraculously increased. In sharp contrast to the deficiency of funds and the scarcity of food at hand, Mark poses all who eat and are filled with much left over, in spite of the vast size of the gathering. In contrast to a sacramental meal in which the people receive only a morsel, Mark emphasizes that their hunger was fully satisfied. In a sacramental meal, in a communion, a Eucharist, you know, you get a little tiny wafer and a little tiny juice or wine. Here, you know, it's a full meal. You know, it's not anything spectacular.
No. But everyone has what they need. Yeah.
No one is hungry yet at the end. And the remaining food was collected into 12 baskets. Again, some scholars see a significance in the 12 here and the 7 baskets with the 4,000. 12 represents the completeness of Israel, whereas 7 represents completeness of the whole world. So,
and going from Israel in the first part of the book to the whole world later in the book.
So the story begins with nearly nothing but ends with an overflow. What might be some implications for us and our world?
Well, again, when you've got nothing left to give, either emotionally or physically, when you're trusting in God, you can become a conduit. And God can do the giving through you. And yes, you still need to take a break, take care of yourself. But sometimes God can do the giving through you when you've got nothing left to give.
And also, when you come to the end of your own means, and you decided to just rely on God to supply your needs because you can't supply them yourself, then God supplies with an overflow.
Yeah, here's some notes that apply this more concretely to the modern world. In God's economy of plenty, there is more than just enough to go around. There is an overflowing abundance. Conventional economic wisdom in the world's prevailing economy is that relentless economic growth, predicated on relentless growth in consumption, is the only mechanism available for achieving the just material aspirations of developing nations without restricting the accustomed material comforts of the developed world. Instead of large-scale economies driven solely by a goal of growth, the story of the feeding of multitudes in Mark invites us to consider small-scale economies driven by a concrete awareness of what the needs are. In such economies, there can be a thoughtful accounting of what is already at hand without additional impacts on the environment, grateful acknowledgement of the bounty God has thus already entrusted to us, and generous acts of sharing these resources in resilient, face-to-face communities. Mark's insistence that there was not much stuff available, only 5 loaves and 2 fish, suggests an orientation away from growth fueled by the consumption of ever more stuff to a recognition that God causes life to flourish in many ways that have little to do with more stuff.
Yeah.
So this story of the feeding of the 5,000 contains many allusions and echoes back to Jewish and Israelite history. It's portraying Jesus as the leader of a new Exodus, a new Israel. Now Jesus alludes to sheep and shepherds and acts in a way that echoes elements from Psalm 23. This story and sign takes place among the Jewish lands, and the next feeding story takes place in Gentile lands.
Oh, okay. It is in Gentile country. Okay.
And now, there are differences of detail, some significant, among the four accounts of this story.
And that's okay.
The what of the gospel is important, but without a proper why or the motivation, the what is of little lasting value. Or put another way, the why needs to drive the what and how of the gospel.
Right. With the gospel in general, if you just make a set of rules and say, this is what you're supposed to do, without the emotional drive behind it, then it becomes meaningless.
Yeah. Jesus has already taught them, the disciples, what to say and do, and has commissioned them to preach in the villages of Galilee. Having had good success with these things, now he has another assignment for them. You give them something to eat. Sermons can form people into active disciples of Jesus, who by feeding the hungry and performing other acts of kindness become the means by which his divine compassion is extended to the world and his commandments are kept. The question that Herod pondered, who is Jesus, is the same question the crowd is also forced to consider. Now, what we have noted about the feeding account here amounts to a clear indication that Mark intends his readers to see the event as disclosing not only Jesus' miraculous power, but also the secret of his person and significance. That is, feeding miracle is really more about Jesus than bread. And like everything else in Mark, it presses the reader to consider who Jesus, the son of Mary, really is. So we might say that this unit is going to try to answer the question, present pictures that hopefully we will form the answer to the question, who is Jesus?
Oh my goodness.
We need to go back to bed.
Look at her temper.
What?
Shoes. Over there.
So, kind of what I see is that when the disciples were sent out to proclaim the gospel and to cast out demons, that's actually easier than having compassion for the people.
That makes sense. Casting out demons and performing miracles is nothing compared to having compassion on people.
Yeah, like actually having to go take care of them, what?
Uh-huh.
You want to go outside? You want to go outside with Daddy? I'm going to go outside and run around in the grass. It's crazy. And I know you're just like a freaking little...
Run around in the frost.
Can't sit still.
Okay. Energize your body. Don't contain me.
So I think that's why I kind of titled this, What's More Important Than Proclamation?
Uh-huh. Motivation. Uh-huh. Yeah. You can, 1 Corinthians 13, you can cast out demons and you can do all this and this and this and this, but if you have not love, then what good is it? That's what he's saying to the disciples, to the apostles.
And finally, the disciples see that when the resources God has entrusted to his people are received in thanksgiving and shared with generosity, there is enough. In the process, in the work of ministry, there will always be enough to accomplish what God wants accomplished.
Well, yeah. If you say, I can't share because I'm not sure that I'll have enough for me, then you're not going. There's not going to be enough. But when you just do what needs doing, then, and if society as a whole does that, just do what needs doing, then, yeah, there will definitely be enough.
Well, it may be that the disciples were kind of hoarding what little they had because they weren't sure where they were going to be able to get the next meal.
Right.
Now, that's one way of looking at it.
And if you hoard what you've got because you're not sure, then there won't be enough. But when everyone just shares with who needs it, especially if you interpret the parable as saying that when they started sharing, then everybody who had something got it out and started sharing, then when society just shares with those who need it, then it's not a problem.